Today's Keisho will be on case 10 in the Blue Rock Collection, Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 10 is entitled Bokushu's Empty-Headed Fool. Ango's Introduction. Yes is yes and no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones, and the religious teachers of the whole world become spiritless and silent. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, and all creatures become brilliantly illuminated and as independent as a 10,000-fathom cliff. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward? If there is any rule, rely on the rule. If there is no rule, follow a precedent. See the following. Main subject. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a cut's shout. Bokushu said, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, "What about it? The third and fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Secho's verse. Two shouts, three shouts, the knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him, expose him to the world. This is the third day of our August session, and again, you know, everybody is just doing a wonderful job. This morning, the sitting in this room was so still. It was just wonderful. I mean, three sits in a row, that's pretty challenging, and many places have maybe a 45-minute sit, and then they do 15 or 20 minutes of walking meditation. And then they sit down and they might do another half hour or something like that. But, I mean, we sit down and we don't get up again for an hour and a half, right? So that's very challenging. And yet this room was so still this morning. It was just wonderful. And usually at a session, there are people who are struggling mightily, you know, and those people are doing their best, but they're having a hard time, you know. So, you know, after the first bell rings, you'll just see them sprawled out on their mats sometime, many times people, you can hear the shifting, you know, today it was so still, you know, so still. It was just really wonderful, and I have to say that I've just been astonished at the beginners, the first timers here, are just astounding to me. I mean, I just keep feeling like something's wrong with this picture, you know, because they're doing such a wonderful job. I just don't get it. And I'm expecting people to come into Dogasan and be like I was. You know, my first session was so difficult. And there was no question of sitting half lotus or something. That was out of it. I was just trying to survive, it just seemed like I could barely walk. You know, I'd get up and I would just be, it would be like I felt like I'd been hit by a car or something, you know. And so I'm a little bit astonished by these first timers who you know basically come into Dokusan, how's it going, and they don't burst into tears. Good, having a good time. Like, what? You are. You know? I'm jealous. It's pretty amazing, you know. And this morning, Masa A. Is that pronouncing? Am I getting that right? It just give me another couple years, I'll get it. It started out as Masai E, and I said, no, wrong. Masa A, not Masai A, it's Masa A. I'll get it. I am still working on Zhao Zhou. It's Joshu, and in Mandarin it's something like Zhao Zhou. But for a long time I was saying Zhao Zhou. And Jaru would just look at me very politely and not say anything. And then I said to Yvette, I said, this is like Master Zhao Zhou. And she looked at me like, huh? And I said, Zhao Zhou. And then she said something like Zhao Zhou. No, she said, she started laughing at me. She said, no, it's Zhao Zhou. But that's not quite right. You know, I can't do the tones. So when I do it, it's like Zhao Zhou. Zhou. And I'm trying to get it. You know. So please forgive me. I'm there's a part of my wiring in my head. It's Masa A. But to me, there's a part of my wiring that says, no, that can't be right. You know? So it's like, every time I'm trying to learn that, my brain wipes it out and says, no, that's wrong. So it's something early imprinting, you know, I just can't get it. But I will, because I'm determined, you know, I'm determined. If for no other reason, you're such a lovely person, such a wonderful person, and you're such a good sitter, I must say. I've just been, this morning, after the second sit, I look around, I sort of open my eyes and I peek around. And then I ring the bell, and I look down there, and I thought, well, I'm sure she's going to want to uncross her legs. No. You know, it's like, what? What? And then the next sit, went through the next sit, you know, gets up. Wow. That's amazing. I still can't do that, you know? That's amazing. So anyway, there's something about the spirit of, the way you're practicing, all three of you, all four of you, that's very impressive, you know? Very impressive. But everybody else is doing a wonderful job, too. It's really marvelous. And one other thing about this name issue, you know, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, couldn't say my name either. He was from Japan and he couldn't say Kurt. That was like impossible. So sometimes he would try to say, it would come out like cut. But, and then it would be Kato. But he wasn't happy with that. So sometimes he'd just go, you. Kato, you. And finally, I got an ordination named Taido, and then from then that was easy. He could have Taido. So anyway, he couldn't say my name either. And then my second teacher, Webb, was an American, but he would forget my name. You know? That's the truth, you know. And we have been practicing for years, and we'd be at Sesshin, and he'd look over at me, and he would be like, you know, I could see him drawing a blank, you know, he would be like, you know, you. So forgive me, please. My heart is in the right place, I assure you. And so anyway, we're all here today. practicing. And it's very important to just keep up the good work you're doing. You know, we have a prejudice in the modern world for complexity, especially intellectual complexity, you know. And so, you know, we love ideas and information, and we like to have plenty of information coming at all times through all these different channels, you know. So, we have, you know, when I was growing up, you had TV and you had books, basically. There were just a couple channels of formal information. And TV was really terrible. It's not that much better now, but there was a show about a talking horse called Mr. Ed. Mm-hmm. There was a show about a guy who is out hunting rabbits, and his bullet goes down into the water of a pond, and oil comes out, and he becomes a millionaire, and he leaves the hills of Tennessee and goes to California, but still thinks he's a hillbilly in Tennessee. There was a show about a man who was stranded on a man named Gilligan who was stranded on an island. Right? And TV, in other words, was, you know, really stupid, you know. And so you could read books or you could watch TV if you got too bored with the TV. But now, you know, there's all these channels of information, and it's, you know, you can be watching TV, but you can have your I think it's an iPod. I don't actually own one, but the one that has the music on it, you know. You can put that in your ear, and you can watch TV and listen to music at the same time, or you can listen to your music and you can be reading, so you can listen to, or you could, you know, so you can have all these streams of information, you know. And also you can carry on conversations while you walk around. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I used to get on the bus to go to the Zen Center, and sometime there was a poor, unfortunate man who had a mental illness, really. And he would be on the bus and he'd be going, "No! You know, shut up!" You know, and then he'd say, "I'm not going to do that!" You know, and everybody would just sort of think, "Whoa!" You know, and this poor guy was, talk about haunted by ghosts, right? But now this happens to me all the time. I'm walking down the street and I hear him go, "Oh yeah, okay, sign me up!" You know, I look, there's no phone in his hand, you know. He doesn't have any little communicator like on Star Trek, you know. He's carrying on, and he might be having, maybe he has an iPod in one ear and a phone thing, jack, in the other ear, you know. We have this illusion that this makes us more intelligent, that having all of these streams of information make us more intelligent. But I really don't think that's true at all. They're very addictive, by the way. You know, when I was a little kid, I noticed when I was about 11 years old that TV was very addictive. Maybe you're not addicted to TV, but in my family, people would come home at the end of the day and turn on the TV, and everybody would sit there. And the stuff on TV was just terrible. And you would think we would have gotten up and just turned it off, right? And said, "Well, this is stupid. You know, let's turn it off and go for a walk." No. Everybody would sit there and turn the channels. It's like, if we keep turning these channels long enough, we're going to find something that's interesting, you know? And now you don't have to get up and you can use a little remote. But, you know, people sit there and they change the remote channels. It's like, why don't they just turn it off? But I'm sure that there's 350 channels. There must be something, the roller skating chef, right? You know, there's something interesting out here, right? This is the world we live in, and yet we don't get up and turn it off, even though in a certain way it's kind of unsatisfying. We feel, I think, computers are like this too. I've noticed even I have a kind of like a computer addiction, where I'll go online and I'll read the New York Times. I, after I sit You often go for a walk, and then if I get to work and I don't have a meeting, sometimes I'll read the New York Times online. So I'll read the New York Times, I'll read Salon.com sometime, and alternate. And then I'll go like, well, what's in the LA Times? What's on, you know, and then, you know, and pretty soon, in like an hour at least, is shot, you know. And I feel like this hunger. It's like something out there on the internet is, there's a piece of information that is going to make me so happy when I find it, right? And then I get the information and it's just like, oh yeah, yeah, oh this isn't it. It's very much like TV. It's very, I think the internet is actually quite addictive. I think you can burn up hours and hours of time surfing the internet. And I guess I'm not the first person to notice that. But there's something very addictive, and it's like the information you get, generally speaking, is not satisfying, but you know there's like a universe of information out there. It's just like TV, you know. I think these other channels of information are like this too, you know. I deal with like the intellectuals, you know. These are people who pretend that they don't watch TV, but they really do, right? So they go, oh, I'm going to go home and read Heidegger tonight, you know. What's on the wire, you know? And they, they value very highly lots of information streams, you know. If you look at an academic article in English, it's heartbreaking because it might be 30 pages long, and then you get to the works cited, all the authors. And if it's a really high-powered work, it's like there's 80 authors there, you know, or 50 authors. And what the writer is trying to show is, look, I've tapped into all these information streams, you know. I'm drawing on all this information. And, intellectuals, so-called, you know, have a great importance on getting the freshest and the latest information, you know. So when I was going to graduate school, there was a person everybody had to read, you had to read him if you were in graduate school. His name was Pierre Bourdieu. I think I got that one right. Yeah. Pierre, close. My mother would correct my pronunciation, but Pierre Bourdieu. And Monsieur Bourdieu was a sociologist, and he had a whole theory about how society works. And everybody, when I went to graduate school, one day I went into class and we were talking, somebody said, it's like Bourdieu says. And then I thought, who's Bourdieu? You know, and it's like, you haven't read Bourdieu? You know, so you have to go read Bourdieu, and then next time I come to class and say, this reminds me of something in Bourdieu. And by then everybody said, oh, he's old news, you know. He's out of date. So the other day I was having a discussion with somebody, and somebody said, it reminds me of something by Badiou. Really, there's really a guy named Badiou. And I said, do you mean Bourdieu? And he said, no, not Bourdieu, Badiou. Right? Everybody has that. You haven't read Badiou, you know? So I'm back in the same, it's like, oh my God, I read Bourdieu, but now I've got to read Badiou. You know? And they're really, I'm not kidding, there's a Bourdieu and there's a Badiou, and they're totally different. I don't think there's any, the only thing they have in common is their names sound similar, you know? But Badiou's totally different, you know? So I have to read Badiou, you know? Now, you know, I actually learned a lot by reading Bourdieu, you know. I benefited in all kinds of ways from that, you know. So, but all the same, you know, it's an information-rich society, you know, where there's all of this stuff flowing. Everybody's reading Bourdieu and Badiou and Derrida and Foucault and Habermas, and you're reading all this stuff, and you've got to keep up. And there's a kind of... again, people who are in that stream feel like I'm really with it. I'm really connected. It's just like having the TV on, the iPod, and the computer at the same time. Or someday maybe it's already possible to watch TV and word process all on the same screen. I don't know. Maybe that's, I guess that is possible, isn't it, if you have windows. So you could be writing, then you could flip to the TV online, and then you could be listening to your music. It seems a very rich environment. And the same thing is true for, like, ideas, you know. If you've read all these guys, whenever you take any subject, opening a can of peas, you know, you can say, well, here's what Bourdieu would say, here's what Badiou would say. You know, he'd say, where are these peas made? You know, probably in the third world, you know, and he'd have some complex idea about it, you know. And in a way, it feels rich. But and it makes us feel maybe more intelligent, yeah, more intelligent. But I wonder if we're more intelligent now. I really question that. You know, I really question that. I'm not sure we're more intelligent. I think we have more information, but I don't believe personally that we're more intelligent. I don't think people are behaving, say, more intelligently than at other times. You know, it's the last century, the 20th century, was the bloodiest century in human history. Isn't that interesting? So the 20th century was supposed to be the best century. We had public education, we had airplanes, we had TV, radio, and we had newspapers. You know, so it's supposed to be the best. And in fact, it was the bloodiest century in history. And that's like a mystery, isn't it? How was it when we had all this information, we did such a bad job with it, you know? And of course, I myself meet people all the time who are like saturated with information, who are not particularly happy people, or not particularly, I would say, intelligent people, really. You know, I would say. My friend Richard Miller is chairman of the English department, and he was telling me that about a colleague of ours who's very famous, who walked into his office, and this person's a very brilliant woman, and Richard said she came in, and she burst into sobs. Because she didn't have enough shelving space in her office. And she just said, this is intolerable. I don't have enough shelves. And it was just like weeping profusely. And, you know, that's odd, right? Like, highly developed intelligence in one way, but on another level, not very intelligent, right? I mean, there's different kinds of intelligence, you know. So there's nothing wrong with reading Bourdieu or Badiou, but we're not necessarily that intelligent. That information doesn't necessarily make us more intelligent. It's possible that I'm, you know, just totally wrong about this, but if you look around, I think you'll agree that there can be people who have a lot of information at their disposal, but they don't live very intelligently, and I think that's quite interesting. On the other hand, I have met people who don't have a lot of intelligence in a formal sense, who do have a kind of clarity or a kind of depth to their experience, you know, which I don't always find in people who, you know, modern people like myself, you know. English professors are very much addicted to information, lots and lots of information. So, you know, we like poetry, you know, we do. I mean, it's English professors like poetry. So, you know, when you read a poem, If you come into a class and you say, it's poetry, introduction to poetry, poetry 101, and you read the poem and you come into class and the teacher says, well, what did you think of the poem? If you say, it moved me very deeply, the professor would say, oh, that's nice, but now let's talk about the poem, In other words, we're not really going to talk about your response to the poem. We're going to talk about the poem in a different way. We're going to talk about the meaning of the poem. And what we'll do is we'll analyze the poem in terms of like abstract ideas, you know. So we'll try to tease out of the poem all of these complex messages. And we might even say, you know, this poem reminds me of something by Monsieur Bourdieu. You know? Oh, excellent! You know, if you can get Bourdieu in here, that's good, you know. So the idea is to tie into the poem all these different streams of information, you know, to bring them all into the poem and make all these connections. And the more connections you make, the more smart you become, you know, or you seem, or you know. That's the art of talking about a poem, is being able to bring all of these streams of information into the poem. Now, this is not bad. I'm not knocking this, because, again, there's something good about this. You know, there is. There's something, being able to do this is important skill. Being able to make connections, be able to take this person and put him next to this person, that's important, you know. If you're a composer, you know, maybe you like Miles Davis, and maybe you like Sting, you know, and maybe you can write music that sounds like Miles Davis meets Sting, you know. And that's okay. Being able to do that kind of thing is okay. But there's something missing to that kind of intelligence, you know, that ability to say something smart or original or make a connection. There's nothing wrong with that, but I think something's missed. There's nothing wrong with that in itself, but there's something missing, you know, there's something missing. And it's not the complexity of an experience that makes it, it's not the intellectual complexity of an experience that necessarily makes it important. It's the depth of the experience, you know, the depth. You know, and in the modern world, we like complexity, but we don't know about depth, I think. We're well educated in complexity, but depth is missing. And you know, it's possible to read a poem, and you read the poem, and all these ideas pop out of your head, you know? So as you read the poem, it's like, just the ideas are coming out of your head like popcorn popping on a grill, you know? And you can say, boy, I really read that poem. But every once in a while, you know, you'll read something, and it just, it reaches down into your heart, it's wrenchingly moving. And maybe it even changes the way you live, you know. You know, you might read something sometime and it's very powerful. It might stick with you for 20 years. And it might affect the way you live your life, you know. Now, if you come into a poetry class and you talk about poetry, you say, boy, this was a very beautiful poem. The professor goes, oh, yes, yes. And you say, it moved me, because, oh, yes, yes, that's not important. But actually, how it affects you, you know, how it changes the way you live, that's very important. And, you know, you could read a poem and it could be very, your encounter with it could be very deep, but not complex, not complex. And we love... we love complexity, but we don't necessarily appreciate depth. And I think Zen, one way to understand Zen is it's about the depth of the experience. It's about the depth of experience. You know, my sister-in-law is a potter, a ceramicist. And she makes these ceramics that are incredibly weird. You know, so... basically, she was onto this one thing where she took different colored clays, you know, so she'd have black clay, red clay, gray clay, and white clay. And she put them together in a block, so that there was like basically one square. If you looked at the block from the side, One square would be white clay, one square would be black clay, one square would be gray clay, and one square would be red clay. And then she has a machine where it's flattened this log of clay, or this rectangle of clay. It's flattened it. And so it made a surface where you got all these different colors together. You know, they were like swirled together, like a little bit like a candy cane stripes, you know, but with four colors. And then she would make bowls out of these. And so you look at the bowls, and there are these swirling colors and everything, and they're very complicated. But you know, to me, they seem shallow somehow. Maybe it's just me, but they're a clever idea, you know, clever, but there's no depth. When I look at them, they're just clever. They don't have any depth. It doesn't really seem to reach down into my heart. Maybe it does for her. I don't know. But she also makes cups, which are... she used to work in a cake factory, and she used to decorate cakes. And she would do wedding cakes, with beautiful wedding cakes, with different colored flowers, and she'd make little vines and little flowers in different colored frosting. So she'd have grapes with purple frosting, and then the leaves would be... And she was quite a talented artist. And then she started making ceramics like this. So she'd make a vase just decorated just like were cake decorations. And they're incredibly complicated. But again, it's not so moving. Every once in a while, I'll find something like... Jaru sent me... from China, she sent me an incense burner. And it was made, it's just a cylinder with three legs, and it's made with natural glaze from, probably from ashes, from some kind of wood ash. And it's sort of white, but it has tones from the heat in the kiln. And it's a little bit crackled, the glaze, you know, and for me, it's very moving. There's much less information, you know, here. There's not a lot of colors. There's not a lot of going on visually, you know. But the simplicity of it, it seems like it somehow reaches, to me, it reaches like deep into me, you know. And I think the simplicity is part of that. You know, the ability to, it's like underneath all of this information, underneath all the top level of our minds is just like a beehive of information, you know? And then underneath that level, there's like the discriminating mind, which is saying this is good and this is bad and this is yes and this is no. And then under that, there's the imagination and so on. It's churning out images and so on and so on. You know. But there's a level to the mind where all of this stuff is out of the way, you know. And it's like experiencing things. I don't know how to put it, but it's like you're the first person on earth to see this, and it's like I don't know how to describe it, but you know, years ago. I was in graduate school, and I was under so much stress. I was so unhappy, and I was working myself into a frazzle. And my wife said, "Look, you've got to take a break," you know. And I said, "Okay, I hate to take the time. I should be studying my books and getting more information," you know. But I said, "Okay." She said, "Let's go to the zoo," you know. So we went to the zoo, and I'm not a fan of zoos, you know. Because the animals are in cages, and it makes me kind of sad. So anyway, we went to the zoo, and we're looking at all these animals, and we walked by the lion cage, and the lion just started roaring. And it blew the top of my head off, you know? It was like it went through my whole body, and I just felt lifted up, you know? It was so moving to me. It's like... primal, right? You know, we have a word primal. It's like that's That sounds so ancient. That's been here for so, it seems to me, so long. That's been here so long. And it was so elemental, right? It didn't have a content. Like, it wasn't like Heidegger. There wasn't any philosophy of a roaring, right? He doesn't have a roaring philosophy. He doesn't have it was conveying information, but very simple, very direct, you know, and the lion was using his whole being to roar, I would think. And it went through me. It was just like the hairs on my head stood up, you know. Now that's a deep, that experience with very powerful quality, you know, not a lot of information, but it was very deep, you know, and it affected me very powerfully. I could give some other examples of this, you know. My first year of graduate school was also, this was later in graduate school, my first year of graduate school was also very stressful. And as it turns out, I had had worms, you know, I hope you won't think less of me, but I got intestinal parasites in my wanderings, and I didn't know it, you know, so I started graduate school, and I started losing weight, and I thought, gee, it must be the stress. And I was losing more and more and more weight, and also I had to go to the bathroom all the time. You know? I thought that must be stress too. And it got so bad that I was so weak and tired. I went to the doctor and I said, you know, I used to be able to run like 3 or 4 miles. Now I can hardly do a mile. I'm exhausted. And they did some tests, and what do you know? It turns out I had worms. But I was so run down. And they can just give you a pill and the worms go away. But when I would go to bed, I would go and say, good night, Barbara. And then I'd go, good night, guys. They'd go, good night. I think I got them in Mexico, so they'd go, good night, senor. Buenas tardes. But I was so run down. And anyway, we went another time. My wife said, come on, get out of the house. You've got to do something. You're going crazy. So we went down to the Pike Place Market, this place in Seattle. And there were some American Indians there. And they had their drums and they were chanting. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Heard American Indians chanting. It's very, I can't, you know, imitate it. But it's deeply... It's very simple, and it was like a public performance of this Indian music, you know, and I was down there, you know, people were sitting there with their shopping, the objects they bought downtown, and they're sitting there, and I sat down, and these Indians started singing, and I just sobbed like a baby, you know. It was just like, holy crap, you know, it was like somebody had wrung me out like a claw, you know. It just reached into my depth of my whole being, you know. And this is very much, you know, I think modern people are shallow. You know, we've got a lot of information, but we're very, very shallow. And we are uneducated, or we're quite stupid on a certain level. And Zen is about re-educating ourselves, how to experience with depth. You know, I could go on and on. You know, you know, when you're sitting here. And your mind is blank and dark. You know, all the information is pushed aside. You know, and you can, and then you hear the crickets. You know, it's possible to have a kind of depth to your experience that you don't normally have. You know, now this isn't always easy to achieve, because indeed we are. Like haunted, you know. One of the problems of becoming addicted to information is that, you know, information isn't neutral. right? It's tied in with all of these fears, all of these aspirations, all of these desires, all of this anger, you know. And so it takes a long time to be simple, a long time. And you know, modern people don't appreciate it. You know, modern people don't. When I was in graduate school, we were discussing a poem. What do you know? And one of the professors, I was in a discussion where it was graduate students and professors, and we were all talking about a poem. And one of the professors, her name was Ramona Modiano, and she said, you know, I think this poem is, she said, I think at least as important in the poem as the words are the silences around the words. And I'm not kidding. Many of the people in the room laughed at her. They laughed. You know, come on. That's like New Age crap, right? You know, they laughed at her. Now, they didn't even understand this issue of death, you know. Now, they were not bad people, you know. I knew them personally. They had many good qualities. So it's not as though they're evildoers, in the words of our president, you know. But they just weren't, that part of themselves was not well developed, you know. And in many ways I would say that's the most important part of ourselves, because when we're just in the world of like shallow information, we're pulled this way and that way and this way and that. We don't know who we are, what we want to be. And it's just, you're just washed with the in and out with the tides of fashion, you know, tides of information. But it's possible to live from a different place, you know. And when you are in the moment, in this thoughtless state, you know, when you're empty-headed fool, you know, what could be more contemptible than to say he's empty-headed? What an empty-headed. Actually, you know, try it. Be an empty-headed fool today. You know, everything, you know, the truth is, you know, in a way, when you have too much information, it deadens everything. Right? Deadens everything. You know, one of the problems like composers have is to do something more and more original. So, you know, these Indians were just beating a drum. They just had like three drums. And there's just like there were three layers of the music, you know. There were like three or four layers, and it's very slight variations, but it just wrenched my heart out of my body, you know. That kind of power is we sort of lost touch with that, you know. But living that way is really quite wonderful. You don't have to give up the other stuff. You know, you can go back and read Monsieur Badieu if you want. Anything you want to do. But at the same time, you know, there's this. I think being in touch with this level is very energizing. It brings everything to life. And it helps us to navigate in this, you know, crazy world of images and images of images of images, you know, and ideas of ideas of ideas. So, you know, maybe it's hard. You're having a hard time breaking out of that spell, that collective hallucination. But you know, the method is very simple. You know, just straighten the back. Breathe from your dantian, your hara. Squeeze the breath out. The breath goes out, 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 out. And at the end of the breath, there's like this blank place. Now, please stay there for 30 years. Really. All I can tell you is, you know, life gets more and more beautiful. Just unspeakably beautiful. You know? And I think it's a wonderful way to live. So please, today, be an empty-headed fool. Be an empty-headed fool. Don't have any shame about it, you know. It's absolutely wonderful.